Welcome to Slug's bi-weekly Slug Soundwaves podcast. Here, in our print mag and on slugmag.com, enjoy our curated content that highlights the best of Utah's alternative and underrepresented music, arts, events, and community subcultures. If Slug has benefited you or someone you love, consider contributing to sustain our existence. Head to slugmag.com/donate to join our community of donors.
KRCL was founded in 1979 to bring a more diverse voice to Salt Lake City and surrounding areas. KRCL is community funded and supported, which allows diverse commercial free programming that varies from indie to hip hop, blues to bluegrass, metal, punk, indigenous, and bilingual programs. Every weekday at 6 p.m., KRCL's Radioactive brings you grassroots activism and civic engagement with punk rock farming and live local music on Fridays. Tune in to KRCL at 90.9 FM. Stream at krcl.org or download the app on the App Store.
Shh! Are you listening?
This is Slug Soundwaves.
The Melons are a four-piece Baroque pop band in Salt Lake City. The band formed in 2020 and was signed by the label Earth Libraries in 2021. The following year, the group released their first full-length album called Introducing the Melons. If you've ever heard their music before, you know their sound has an indisputable reminiscence of the 1960s and 70s. In this episode, they examine that and talk about the qualities of that era that live in their sound. Plus, how the album was written while multiple members were questioning their religious faith, and how some of those emotions found their way into the sound too.
We're the Melons!
My name's Rob Jepson. I mostly play the keyboards and some guitar and sing in the band.
I'm Denny Fuller, and I mostly play the Hofner violin, bass, and sing, and a little bit of horns as well.
I'm Andrew Beck, and I play guitar a lot, and keys, and I sing too. We all sing, except for you.
Yeah, good segue. I'm Ian. Ian Francis. I do not sing. I play the drums.
I think the Melons is a lot of stuff, but we call it Baroque pop because it's sort of like rock and roll, but where rock and roll and classical music kind of met experimentally in the 60s. So you've got guitars, bass, and drums, and singing and harmonies, but then you also have like trumpets and tubular bells and strings and French horns and stuff. So it's kind of like orchestral rock and roll.
We're kind of Baroque pop for the 21st century. We want to not be a retro or vintage act per se, but also have one foot stepping forward at all times. Or maybe we have one foot backwards in the past and one foot forwards, kind of. So we're kind of just like interestingly, I don't know if straddling's the right word, but we're trying to artistically straddle the right time period.
I'm always, which trying is to, nice. always trying to straddle stuff, you know what I mean?
Horses, tasks,
drum seats,
drums, drum thrones.
Yeah, yeah.
Get it right.
Sorry, yeah. I need the correct vernacular. I always say, as like a very blanket statement, that we're very Beatles, Sgt. Pepper-esque. I feel like that's a good starting point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'll never say that we're like the Beatles, because that's that could mean anything. But we are like the Beatles. But specifically, like Denny
like
said,
a certain part of the Beatles.
Yeah, Sgt. Pepper's Magic Mystery Tour. I feel like that's a good starting point, because sometimes when I say we're like Baroque pop, I feel like that's such an accurate description. But I see people's eyes glaze over sometimes when I say that. So
like if Pet Sounds and Sgt. Pepper's had a baby, kind
yes,
of thing,
a Baroque baby,
we would be the one trying to like be like, I love you, parents. My parents are Sgt. Pepper's and Pet Sounds. We're like, we're trying to be our own person.
Yeah.
Kind of that sounds real dumb, but maybe you get the analogy.
Yeah. The reluctant child of the Beach Boys and the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where we're like, we're trying to make a voice of our own. And they're like, you're just going to be me.
Wow. Over the years, I think wondering what genre to work in was a big question for me. Most of my life, I would write a song and I was like, well, there's a weird Jack Johnson-esque song, and then I'd write like a little classical music piece on the piano, and it was all very unfocused, and there's just like not very much power in it being so disparate and confused. So I don't know, for a long time I wondered like, what like style should it be, you know? And I think just since this type of music is my favorite type of music to listen to and to like be interested in for myself, I was like, why shouldn't I like work in that genre, you know, like make that kind of music.
I definitely feel like there's a four-way Venn diagram with us. Like, we all have unique tastes and preferences, but there's definitely a sweet spot where we all love this type of music. But I do think we all love it for slightly different reasons, which I find very cool. So in my house growing up, I was the youngest, and I kind of leaned on my older siblings' musical tastes. And when I started tuning into music, there was like 90s radio, like 94.9 ZHT, which I still love all of that music. And then there was all the 60s stuff. So my brothers would bring home Bob Dylan, Simon Garfunkel, of course the Beatles, Cat Stevens was a big one, Jim Morrison. So for me, that was my first dose of like, this is what good music is, because the cool people in my life listen to this stuff. And then I sort of moved on and didn't really listen to that type of music for a long time. And then as this band was forming and we had to crystallize what genre are we going to be, for me what's attractive about it is kind of two things. One, the music is more complex, I feel like. Like, pop music has an appeal. I love pop music, but generally speaking, it's more straightforward and simpler. A lot of the music from the 60s is so multifaceted and layered, and I really like that. The second one for me is I feel like the songwriting from that era had a sincerity to it. People were very candid, vulnerable. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, I would say, was at the forefront of that. But even John Lennon, with all his sarcasm, he used his music to really deliver pretty vulnerable messages sometimes.
Where people were talking about what was happening in those times.
Yeah.
Like very, very relevant to politics or philosophy.
Totally.
Or new ideas, or as opposed to now. I'm not saying that there isn't good music being made now. We are part of that. But, but like... Yeah, it's like they were talking about the issues that were like, okay, you know, Robert F. Kennedy was just assassinated. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a bunch of music that comes out about that right there.
Yeah.
The drumming of the 60s for me is very fascinating because I feel like there's a transition going on in that period. There's a lot of transition within the 60s era generally, I think. But you look at like Ringo, his drumming style has a very cool kind of swingy, jazzy, and sort of like rootsy rock and roll feel to it. And I feel like that style is found a lot in the 60s style of drumming. So that's always fascinated me. It's always been this transitional time, not as a culture, but you know, you can hear it even in a style of drumming. It's been great to dive more into that with the Melons and also put more of a modern twist on it as well to blend the style of the 60s and also more modern musical and drumming styles.
We don't stray away from like letting our millennialisms or whatever in, because we could totally make our music be more lo-fi and sound more true to maybe like the early 60s or whatever, mid 60s. But then I feel like we would be doing a disservice sometimes because we put so much into the arrangements or something that you'd be missing things. So, or you'd be missing the kick drum, which is like a lot of the early Beatles recording. You're just like, you can't hear like the power of... You don't even hear like that intensity, yeah, or whatever. But now with modern recording technology or whatever, it's way easier to just get a high fidelity recording, mm-hmm, at my house or something, you know, wherever we're, yeah, recording kind of thing.
And it goes back to like that transitional period of early on, the kick drum wasn't that... We can get really nerdy here, all right?
We're not doing it.
The kick drum wasn't even...
Nerd!
From what I've learned, the kick drum wasn't even that of like a priority, you know, like it wasn't supposed to be loud and driving, but now it's like it's the beat, you know, it's what makes people move and dance. And as music got louder throughout the 70s and the 80s, the drums got bigger and the kick drums got bigger. You look at John Bonham repping a 26-inch kick drum, you know. Yeah, it's I see what you're saying, Denny. Like, we want to record music that is similar, that harkens back to what we love in that era, but also we want to put some kind of modern twist on it, and we want people to hear the kick drum.
Something I really enjoy about our band and this album in particular is all of us will bring songs to the table. So Andrew's a songwriter, Denny's a songwriter, I'm a songwriter. And we all start songs, and sometimes we get them 60% finished, sometimes 80% finished, sometimes like 20% finished, and then we bring it to the band and finish it together. So I feel like it's really hard to say, with one or two exceptions, it's hard to say, like, I wrote that song, or Denny wrote that song. There are outliers like that, but for the most part, it's a pretty beautiful mess of, like, collaboration. Yeah. And I love that about the album. My favorite example of that is the song Surprise. So Surprise has two pretty distinct parts, part A, part B. Part A I wrote by myself, but it was just piano and voice. Actually, I wrote a little bit of an introduction too, and some bass parts that some of them made it in. And then Denny and Andrew pretty much took it from there, and Ian took it from there on drums. And then I would say Denny and Andrew wrote the second part, and I complimented with like a little bit of piano, I think, and Ian wrote his own drum part. So I think that's pretty emblematic of how the band works. And it's something I really, really enjoy. I think for me, Surprise kind of captures the turmoil of personal relationships. That song's pretty coded. Like, it has a story that you can follow. It has a narrative. But for me personally, it's about relationships falling apart and being redefined, or relationships being threatened. And like the risk of losing dear relationships is what that song's kind of about for me. So the album was primarily written during COVID, so all of us were going through that. Andrew left the LDS Church probably closer to the beginning of the process. I think I left the LDS Church sort of more in the middle of the process. So that, for me, was a very emotionally raw time. Candidly, I was pretty depressed at work. I was working from home, working like in my shed, you know, for almost 2 years. It was just like a grim time in life anyway. Then I left the church, and that sort of upends everything. It's like, oh my gosh, what are my values? What are my relationships like? How do I feel about my family and they about me? What is the point of my art? What am I trying to say? Am I trying to fit in with anyone? Or am I trying to put a stake in the ground to represent my own values? It's a lot. And I don't know that that conversation ever ends, really. I mean, I think a healthy person is always having that conversation in their head, regardless of whether they're in a church or not. And actually, that's something I really admire about Ian. Ian is in the LDS church still, but I look at Ian as someone who's so healthy and mindful about it. And I think you can be a healthy, mindful person in or out.
Yeah, as far as faith, I'm still in the church, like Rob said, and I feel like and anyone's decision to leave the church is just as justified as my decision to stay, you know? To me, it doesn't change anything whether someone is or out of the church. It hasn't affected the band or how I see anything.
I think a lot of my emotion that comes through on the record is through arranging. The song that I sing lead on is called Marmalade, but most of the lyrics are written from our friend Andres Mitchell of the Poppies, who's also in the local scene here as well. So even my words don't necessarily come out in the record very much. So I think more of my contributions emotionally come out in this record from what I was going through or whatever at the time, which is slowly falling away from my faith as well kind of thing and finding my place in the world or whatever. And I'm still, like Rob said, I think a decently healthy person, I agree with him, is always kind of figuring out where you stand and being able to see the two sides of the same coin and live in limbo a lot of the time, actually. And I think art can help you live in that limbo section and be okay with that. I don't know if that's my way to
end that. I love that.
I think my wife and I had been out of the church for like 3 years, so we were definitely still just right in the middle of pretty intense existential turmoil, trying to understand what these guys were talking about. Who am I? What's my place in the world? What's real? What's not real? How do I interact with other people, etc.? That's probably the main thing that was on my mind during writing a lot of these songs. Ashley and I were also dating a woman named Lainey, and I wrote some songs based on that idea, just because that was more like, what is even life? What are even relationships? You know what I mean? Just a time of trying to redefine reality, I suppose. Or realize that you can't redefine reality, as you guys are saying. Like, just realizing you're just kind of in the free fall. Like, well, I guess this is what we're doing. You know what I mean? So, like, Devil's Advocate on the album is specifically about me arguing with my mom about God and about being a Mormon, just because that's a really big source of pain for me, and I'm happy I got to put it into a song. It's funny, she came to our concert the other day, and or, like, months ago, and she was like, oh, I like that one Devil's song. What's that about? And I was like, Mom, we've talked about this so many times. You don't even remember what it's about you. Which just blows my mind.
Love you, Mom.
And she was flattered.
See you later. What a Time to Be Alive is, I think, pretty much a COVID anthem for me, because it was sort of like feeling the pain of life, but also at the very same time, like how beautiful and exciting life is. Mm. Kind of how those two things can be happening at once. The phrase, what a time to be alive, I think is an interesting phrase because of its kind of dual nature. Part of me was saying, like, you know, global pandemic, Donald Trump is the president, like, what a time to be alive, like in a negative way. And then another part of me was saying it in like a truly joyful way, like, wow, what a time to be alive. And I just thought it was an interesting phrase because it not only can it mean both, but in the song it does mean both. You know, it's like we were talking about, like, Dickinson, like, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, you know what I mean? And I think that's, like, kind of a thing. Sometimes you look at your life and you're like, well, this was the worst day ever, but then also it was kind of, like, my favorite day.
The magic of Ian is interesting on this song, because he's such a good and studied drummer, but also is simultaneously very focused on the feel of his playing. He came into the studio at my old studio, Number 9 Studios, on 6 West and 6 South, and we were planning on recording like Devil's Advocate or So Much to Say or whatever other song we were going to work on that was going to take 2 or 3 hours for the drums. Right before, I think, Rob showed up, we were like, oh, maybe we can cut a little demo real quick for this What a Time to Be Alive song, which was only 45 seconds at the time or something. And Andrew's like, what if you hit this do cuts? So Ian does this for like 12 bars. He does 3 different versions of it, one with like a closed hi-hat, one with a slightly more open hi-hat, and one a little bit more open and loose or whatever. And then there's the tom part in the song. And that's the only drums for the whole song. And he recorded those in about 12 or 13, 14, maybe 15 minutes. And I was engineering at the time, so I was trying to get the sound captured really quickly and make sure it was really good. And it ends up being some of our favorite drum sounds on the whole record, and what we get complimented for sometimes from other bands, you know, other contemporaries and stuff. So they're like, well, Ian's feel on this deceptively simple drum beat, right? Because the feel of it is really important, but really took us 15 minutes to record or less.
Right.
There's my Ian compliment. That compliments the whole band, but mostly Ian or whatever. So that's his contributions, which someone might negate as simple or whatever, but I would argue that it's not. It was all the 15,000 hours of drum playing before that led him to be able to track that in 5 minutes, you know, kind of thing. So you're about to hear What a Time to Be Alive from our record, Introducing the Melons, in its entirety.
Yeah.
The Melons are working on a 45 that should be coming out this summer. I have a couple of new songs, and we're also working on a full-length record that should be out next year. And we're going to go on a small tour with our friends Triptides this summer around the Mountain West, so details will be coming about that soon.
If you enjoyed this episode of Soundwaves, please take 60 seconds to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Did you enjoy this episode of Slug Soundwaves? You and the local community can continue to enjoy Slug Mag's content for free, but please consider making a one-time or ongoing contribution. Each contribution, no matter the amount, helps support Slug's creation of thoughtful media coverage on SLC's music, arts, events, and community subcultures. Head over to slugmag.com/donate to make your contribution today.